Okay, we might as well get started, as you're being very good and you're going quiet anyway. My name is Danny Dorling. My job is to keep everybody to time and to keep my opinions to myself, which if you know me, you know I'm going to find the next hour very difficult. And I'll also chair the questions later. We have four excellent speakers in this Greenbelt debate, and we're going to give them each 15 minutes. So please keep your questions right to the end. We have an hour for questions at the end, and there'll be plenty of time to quiz them, harangue them, or whatever you want to do. This is the right place to be discussing this in the country, I think. I can tell you all kinds of reasons as to why, but as I said, I will not. First on, we've got Professor Tim Marshall from the University up here on the hill. Tim's got 15 minutes and hopefully some slides. So can we have a big welcome for Tim, please.
Right, good afternoon. Are we speaking into this?
Yes.
Yeah, that's working, is it?
Yeah.
Good, right. Well, you've got my first slide up here, which I thought quite a while about what sort of title to use for this talk, and I came up with silly ideas like, all with question marks, are red herrings, or a proxy for other issues, which sounded a bit long drawn out. In the end, decided to leave it the rather mysterious, a distraction question mark. But we were asked to answer the question, should the government do something now about the Greenbelt issue? At least I think that's roughly how we were phrased where the question was. And my rather, again, maybe mysterious answer is not as such, and I'll see where that puts me in the spectrum, as it were, of answers that we're going to get in the next hour. I'm going to look at three areas. One is the context, because I think that the Greenbelt's question is in a particularly difficult or more politely challenging set of context, and to deal with it is by no means as easy as you might think it would be, having an easy yes or no answer to what we do with it. Then I'll give a couple of ideas on directions of change and then some proposals. You might go with me some of the way, think there's some value in what I'm saying in the first part, but not the second part, or the first two parts, and not the third part. Obviously, there's a sort of thread running through it, but we'll see, because the what to do bit is rather more difficult, to put it mildly, particularly after what happened last Thursday, and it may be that I'm speaking, as it were, in the wrong historical era. Again, you'll have to judge for yourselves. The general societal context, to put it that way, I think are very, very challenging. Commonly agreed values are easier, if you think of any situation, small or large, to sort out a question if you've got those and if you haven't. Greenbelt stemmed from the period between the 1930s and early 1980s in their conception. So they're quite old now, even the newest one is quite old. And they were put together in a period when most people would say there was a larger national consensus than there is now, around public interest possibly. If we don't have that, how do we progress? The same with politics. Many people think that politics doesn't aggregate societal views very well these days. Possibly it did slightly better at previous historical periods, but that's a historical discussion. But certainly for the last 20, 30 years, I think there have been deep divisions, and politics has not necessarily sort of resolved those. Obviously, governments do things, but they may not be doing things which have a broad consensus around them. And finally, there's a structure of interest present, particularly in the Greenbelt, which I think is deeply entrenched and creates situations of conflict. People have real material interests, landowners, developers, some of the residents locally, some of the residents outside the Greenbelt. You can't just resolve that by having a bright idea. You're going to hit heavy politics. If you look then at my next context, which is the national difficulties, we don't really have a national or strategic concept. We don't have very good data. There hasn't been much stress on evidence base in the last 5 years. national rebalancing is a sort of fig leaf phrase. We have lots of fig leaf phrase, Northern Powerhouse. We have fig leaf projects like the HS2. They are things which avoiding thinking and really thinking through what we're going to do with the whole country in a spatial way. So that gives a difficult context. We haven't really sorted out where we want to deal with this issue. Do we want to deal with the existing cities, which was one of the tracks for many years? Some big new reports like Vital Cities, a report just about to come out called Growing Cities, Sheltering the IPPR, refer again to the centrality of urban policy. This is where we should be really sorting things out. But obviously, there's the rest of the country, and we need to work out the connections between those. And obviously, energy retrofitting existing urban areas is part of the challenge just as much as dealing with urban extension. The third thing, which I'm particularly familiar with, is the weakened planning system. We're trying to resolve something like green belts, possibly, but within a context where the planning system has been systematically made a considerable mess of in the last 10 or more years. So it's very difficult to actually address these issues in a coherent manner. And my third problematic context is, it's not really a problem, it's just a reality. These contexts are very, very variable. The Green Belt of Oxford is quite different from the Green Belt of Cambridge, and comparing the two is one of the common mistakes. The Green Belts of the big Met counties of Yorkshire, the Northwest one, or even the Avon Green Belt, they're different animals. Each of them responds to a very different metropolitan dynamic, a different growth dynamic, a different environmental dynamic. So you need to think about that. You can't necessarily override that by some general national decision. And that applies to all the different elements of those green belts. There will be different ownership structures, different transport connectivity within those green belt regions, if you like to put it that way. And if you just think about all the other areas which don't have green belts, which you can see on this map, which I bet CPRE will recognise, borrowed from them. There are a lot of areas of England which don't have green belts. What about those? Surely they matter just as much. I mean, I'm from Suffolk and my relatives are just as passionate about the edge of Bury St Edmunds or the edge of Ipswich as people are about the edge of Oxford. There's no green belt there. They wouldn't know the language of green belts in Suffolk. But you should think about Suffolk surely as well as Cornwall, as well as many, many other places. So that spatial variability might suggest the need for some sort of geographical approach. So, my sort of two slides on general directions, what we might therefore do about this, starts with this rather solid suggestion that you can't answer the Green Belt without looking at general policy answers, the Green Belt question. It seems to be obvious, but obviously it's not obvious to other people because governments haven't been doing it. They haven't been responding to the land issue. They haven't been responding in a remotely adequate way to the housing question or the transport question or to food issues. And I could go on. I mean, there's a very nice paper just come out, or a thoughtful paper at any rate, by Dieter Helm, energy economist at Oxford University, who's been dealing with the study on natural capital for the government. And he makes quite a strong defence for the Green Belt, rather surprisingly in some ways. And he says basically that the Green Belt can be changed. It doesn't have to sit in the same form that it is at the moment. And we should use it for enhancing biodiversity and so on and so on. So those who want to defend the Green Belt have got some academic supporters coming from possibly unlikely places. It seems to me changing Green Belt on its own will just accelerate the current mess of policy that we have around these various places that have the existing Green Belts. We should really be restructuring urban regions for sustainability and to improve housing affordability. But just taking out a lump here and taking out a lump there, or even worse, which is the way it's actually working now, which is nibbling away by numerous appeals. It isn't, I mean, it would be just a complete accident if nibbling away by numerous appeal decisions resulted in anything remotely useful to society, to put it bluntly. So unless we actually we get some sort of integrated approach, and we should think about those keys really first rather than trying to sort of make a general conclusion about the Greenbelt, which may rather torpedo this afternoon's discussions, but that's my conclusion. Then, if we've once we've sorted that through, we can get the regions, the counties, or whatever we want to call those localities, to look at the issue in the round, in a way which has got a good basis. I mean, to be a little bit more specific, but I haven't got time to be very specific, we should widen the palette, we should go for enhancement. We don't have to use green belts just for farming or urban development. There's a lot of other things you can do with them. We can make the connection to society in a very different way. I mean, I would say green belts in some parts of the country are very much for the affluent minorities. And that doesn't have to be the case. We can think of country parks, which were good innovation of the late 70s by the Met Counties. I think I used to live near Sandwell Country Park in the West Midlands, wonderful area in the Greenbelt of the West Midlands. And there was a project in Sabadell in Spain near Barcelona, which I used to like, which was a 1990s plan, which the council decided to buy up all the land around their city for about an area of 2 miles, gradually over many, many years. And they would use that for all sorts of rural food, energy, development reasons, and it would be in perpetuity, publicly owned. Those areas, I assume, being in Spanish land law, they would buy it at existing use value plus not very much. So that's the sort of thing we ought to be thinking about, much more radically, much more adventurously than we have done in the past. And so we should be looking at cities. We should be looking at 10 or really, I mean, with a bigger city, it would be more than 10 miles around the city. You know, there's a greater sort of gravity effect from a big city than that. London, you'd have to take a regional approach to looking at issues around the green belt. Smaller cities, you wouldn't need so much space. So, but there's a far bigger palette. There's actually 5 minutes. Yeah, thank you. That we can draw on to try and sort this out. Now we get to the bit which I suppose is getting a bit even more unrealistic, if you like. I think we need a big national approach to this. I think we need a framework. There was a study done in 2010, Land Use Futures Report, by the Foresight bit of government, which was binned because it came out just before the 2010 election. It should be brought back, and we should have something like a national commission, I think, to look at these questions, to provide some sort of framework about what we do with the countryside. The academic capacity does exist. There's been superb studies over the last 5 years on national infrastructure systems, because that's one thing the government is interested in. And those have been done by Oxford University and other universities, and it shows that we're perfectly capable of sorting out options for big infrastructure systems. Now, if you link that to our skills to do with land use, farming and so on, we should be up to be able to put an evidence base together. And once we've done that, we've sort of depoliticised the base, the evidence base. We do it outside by an independent agency. We repoliticise it by bringing it back to the public, big public debates, like they do in other countries, and you get the government to take some politically difficult decisions. In other words, you work out what the overall aim is. I mean, do you really want to build on 5% of the land? Do you really want to transform the food system generally across the country, build on less than that? There are lots of big options, which you then need to think of some instruments. You've got money, you've got things like the Common Agricultural Fund monies, you've got other monies which are available now, which you can use as instruments for changing. This may seem all very remote from the Greenbelt, but I don't think it is. It's part of a context in which we need to think about major decisions about the countryside. So we would look then, the second step after you've got this national stage will be that each locality, I mean, obviously local plans will continue for the next few years, so we won't be without a planning framework, we may hope. But in due course, when we get round to this in a few years' time, we would have locality studies, and that would be a moment where you could possibly decide Greenbelt was no longer appropriate for a particular part of the country. AOMBs might not be appropriate for... You might bring in new designations, which will be more appropriate for the 21st century, enhancement areas or something like that. And you would need some binding strategic planning, I'm sorry to say, otherwise people wouldn't believe you. Long term, you're not going to get people to move away from the status quo unless you can make really strong binding promises. And example, I mean, the West Midlands Greenbelt was used for urban regeneration policies. There are plenty of other areas that I chose this one from South Worcestershire. This is three districts. It's got a greenbelt at the top. It's got two AOMBs up, slivers up the sides, Cotswolds and Malvern Hills. But all the rest, 90%+, is countryside. We have to think about that. We don't just have to think about greenbelts and AOMBs. We need to think about the future in a comprehensive way. So my conclusion is, yes, we should act urgently, but not really on the greenbelts as such. So that's why I'm saying not as such is the answer. We need to look at the overall question of how we plan localities, and just changing greenbelts on their own, I think, is just a recipe for getting into a larger mess than we're in at the moment. And we need to understand we are in quite a large mess if we're going to deal with all sorts of challenges, like housing is obviously at the top of everybody's list at the moment. So I think I've stuck to time and I shall sit down.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Our next speaker is Matt Thompson, who's head of planning at the Council for Protection of Rural England. So again, 15 minutes, if you find your slides. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, everyone. Just to be clear, it's the Campaign to Protect Rural England. We've moved on since our old council days. Anyway, to set this little event in context a little bit, I wanted to point out that three of the people you'll be hearing from today are employees of organisations that are promoting the development of Oxford's Greenbelt. Not that that necessarily means those individuals are in favour of the development of Oxford's Greenbelt, but I just think it's worth setting that in context. So, moving on. There. That's the wrong presentation. it's all right. Bear with me a second. I'll just load up. Do you mind if I just pause?
That's fine.
I have got
that. I should say that this gives me a minute while you're doing this to say. Joe and I, when we were trying to pick people to speak, we weren't so much worried about the fact of the slight bias for Greenbelt. Can you guess what the one section of society we really tried really hard to get?
Women.
I
did all with a T for you,
Doug. Thank you very much. I think I came up with only 15 women. Anyway, but this doesn't stop anybody doing that question of why are there no women. I've never tried to get women harder in my life before. Right. Are you ready?
I am. Great. And thank you very much for that little bit of ad hoc entertainment. Yes. Yeah, where are all the women in planning? There's plenty out there in the audience tonight. So, right, so what is Greenbelt? I just thought I'd do a little bit of background. I think everybody knows where Greenbelts come from. I started with the origin of Greenbelt being with Ebenezer Howard's ideas for garden cities and what he at that point called rural belt, simply because garden cities are extremely popular at the moment for reasons that sometimes escape me. The Greenbelt approach then has obviously evolved over intervening years, as Tim pointed out, and we now have a policy in the National Planning Policy Framework that aims to prevent sprawl by keeping land open, and in which the permanence and openness of the Greenbelt are its essential characteristics. And you will hear the word permanence a lot from me today. So the current purposes of the Greenbelt are to prevent towns from merging together, to check urban sprawl, to assist with countryside protection, and it is only assist with countryside protection, not necessarily to protect the countryside, because there's plenty of unprotected countryside out there, to preserve the setting of historic towns and cities, and that's a particularly important one, obviously, for Oxford, and I would go so far as to say, seeing as we are here, that Oxford's Green Belt is absolutely unique and should not be eroded under any circumstances. And finally, to very importantly, perhaps even most importantly, to assist with urban regeneration, because if we don't have the policies that constrain development on greenfield sites around our cities, then it is very difficult for us to encourage the regeneration of brownfield sites within those towns and cities, simply because greenfield land will always be cheaper to develop. So CPRE and the Green Belt, we like to think of ourselves as owning Green Belt. CPRE was founded in 1926. One of its founders was Sir Patrick Abercrombie. He went on to become Honorary Secretary of the CPRE for a number of years. And our current policy, which emerges out of that love for Green Belts, is that we seek the permanent and meaningful commitment to the Green Belt, and that reviews of Green Belt boundaries should only take place in exceptional circumstances, which is exactly what the MPPF says, and as a last resort. But we recognise that you can't accommodate all necessary development on brownfield sites, though we do argue that people should try harder. And as part of this, we recognise that some greenfield development is necessary. But Green Belt serves a range of functions essential to the well-being of people living in urban areas, as well as people living in the countryside that the designation directly affects. And the essential characteristic of Green Belts being permanent is at the heart of existing national planning policy and must be the paramount consideration in any planning decision. Our view is that planning permission for inappropriate development in the Green Belt should never be granted for speculative development, full stop. The evidence that is needed in order to meet the very special circumstances in the MPPF, in our view, requires consideration of alternatives and the integrity of the Green Belt as a whole that can only practicably be achieved through the development plan process or an equivalent comprehensive and strategic process. Objectively assessed need with regard to actual local plans for development in any area is the first step in identifying housing targets, but only the first step, and targets are required by national policy to take account of the constraints afforded by designations such as Greenbelt. There's absolutely no national imperative to release land from Greenbelt simply to meet housing need, even if no alternative sites are available in the local authority area, and even if agreement regarding overspill can't be agreed with neighbouring authorities under the so-called duty to cooperate. National policy rightly allows local planning authorities to review Green Belt boundaries, but similarly correctly directs that these should be very much the exception. Our view is that these exceptional circumstances should be explained more clearly in the practice guidance that accompanies the NPPF in order to avoid what is currently a free-for-all for Green Belt development, where everybody's making decisions ad hoc, really in fear. Local authorities are making decisions in fear of planning appeals and in fear of being unable to adopt a local plan, leaving them potentially without an up-to-date local plan with which to defend their green belt. So the CPRE supports current MPPF policy for green belts, as long as it's implemented as it's intended, without the unintended consequences of the so-called presumption in favour of sustainable development, which I've written down as the presumption in favour of speculative development. That was a bit of a... I'm sure that was a typo. So, the MPPF is clear about the purpose of green belts and that one of their essential characteristics is their permanence. This permanence not only assures communities living in the green belts and in the towns and cities it protects, but it also gives investors confidence. And this is something that is always forgotten by the green belt naysayers. These investors might have interests other than the construction of new homes in the Greenbelt, including businesses that capitalise on its rural nature, and including those who have invested in possibly more marginal developments, such as brownfield sites, but which actually meet the aspirations of local people and are included in local plans. Senior government spokespeople, from the Prime Minister down, have expressed their commitment to the protection of the Greenbelt, often believing that it's being protected better than it actually is. But there have been several clarifications in support of the intention of footnote 9 to the NPPF, which clearly states, footnote 9 to the presumption in favour of sustainable development, which clearly states that local planning authorities don't have to plan to meet objectively assessed needs where Greenbelt applies, and planning permission should not be granted for proposals in the Greenbelt contrary to NPPF Greenbelt policies, even if there is no up-to-date local plan. These principles have been affirmed in revisions to the online planning practice guidance made in October 2014, accompanied by statements very much in favour of protecting the Greenbelt from Secretary of State Eric Pickles and Housing and Planning Minister Brandon Lewis. Farewell to those two, by the way. So, while the Prime Minister, and he is now the Prime Minister again, recently asserted that protection of Greenbelt is paramount and development in the Greenbelt is at its lowest rate for 25 years, this claim is misleading. CPRE research shows that pressure for housing and other forms of inappropriate development in the Greenbelt has increased since the publication of the NPPF, with numbers of houses proposed in Greenbelts rising from 80,000 or so in 2012 to nearly 220,000 in March this year. Houses planned in the metropolitan Greenbelt have tripled in a little over the year and months just been. But stats on development in the Greenbelt have always been misleading. It's not just the Tories. During Labour's tenure, it was claimed that little housing was built on Greenbelt and the overall area of Greenbelt actually increased. But this was because Greenbelt was revised before planning applications were submitted, and the loss of Greenbelt was offset by the redesignation of new areas of Greenbelt, sometimes larger than that was lost, but in areas that weren't under any pressure from housing development and didn't contribute to the reasons why Greenbelt is designated in the first place. And that practice seems to still be happening. And why are councils not following Greenbelt policy and defending their Greenbelts from speculative development? And why are they releasing sites in their local plans? And it's because, as I said earlier, despite repeated ministerial assurance that they should be protecting their Greenbelt, they're still running scared of the developers and they're still scared of the application of the presumption in favour of sustainable development should they not have an up-to-date local plan. I'd just like to expand this map. This is a map from our recent research which shows the... probably not all of the developments, but certainly all the developments we're aware of that are currently with consent in Greenbelt areas. And I'd particularly like to draw attention to this area because that is where the developments are currently taking place that will prejudice David Cameron's expressed desire that his children should be able to walk as they can now from Liverpool to Leeds through Greenbelt protected land. A journey of 77 miles through seven different local authorities, but he's used to leaving his children in pubs, so and that's the rest of the country. As you can see, there's also a strong correlation between where there is development pressure in greenbelts and where there is an awful lot of brownfield land available for development. This demonstrates that people do want to live in areas where there's a lot of brownfield land, which goes against everything that the brownfield naysayers say. Now, at this point, I was going to go through line by line Tom Papworth's report on the Greenbelt, which I do recommend to you if you haven't read it so far. But I won't do that because I don't have enough time. What I will just pick out is, first of all, that while we disagree strongly with the conclusions of Tom's paper, obviously, there is a lot of sensible stuff in it. In particular, there's a recognition that there isn't enough centrally held, mapped data or that is useful to the planning and development industry in England, and the government needs to do something about that. They've already shown that they're interested in restoring the National Land Use Database. Let's hope they do a bit more, because they're not speaking from they're not speaking and making policy informed by actual evidence on the ground. One of the key things that that Tom's paper focuses on is whether green belts are pretty or not. and this is one of the things that a lot of the Greenbelt naysayers focus on. Whether they're pretty or not is irrelevant to their purpose, and other designations exist to protect bucolic idylls, and most of those who campaign against Greenbelts focus on their condition and a narrow definition of environmental benefits that usually focus on biodiversity, and ignore wider benefits such as carbon sequestration, floodwater and runoff absorption, and microclimate benefits. To achieve its purpose, Greenbelt doesn't need to be attractive or historic landscape. It doesn't need to be public park or even accessible to the public. It doesn't need to be a nature reserve or even have any wildlife. That's not what Greenbelt's for. And the fact that a large proportion of Greenbelt is used for intensive agriculture should be welcomed rather than vilified. While some forms of intensive farming have net environmental costs, and you have to remember that farming is an industry and all industries have environmental costs, although they should be mitigated, intensive farming has to happen somewhere. And what better place for it to happen than close to the market that it serves? In our survey with Natural England, from which that map that Tim used came from, 80% of respondents said that they'd prefer to buy food that was marketed as being produced in their local Greenbelt. So why is intensive farming such a problem for Greenbelt naysayers? I shall wrap up very quickly by skipping through the rest of that and ask, why are we talking about this now? Senior government spokespeople, as I've said, from the Prime Minister down, have expressed their commitment to the protection of the Greenbelt. And the new government has been elected on a manifesto commitment to protect the Greenbelt. The Labour Party, on the other hand, failed to mention the Greenbelt and relied on the recommendations of the Lyons Review for most of what they had to say about planning, which was equivocal on the pros and cons of Greenbelt, but even it didn't recommend that Greenbelt policy should be changed. You'll note that they lost the election. The Lib Dems claimed to have fought to protect the Greenbelt in their manifesto, but didn't include a manifesto commitment to protect it. And I ask you where the Lib Dems are now. UKIP's manifesto committed to protecting the Greenbelt, and they experienced a 9.5% swing in their favour. It's still lost, of course, and I'm not entirely disappointed about that. Of course, you can't read a lot into local election results, and people vote for a party for many different reasons. But there probably hasn't been a clearer mandate for retaining Greenbelt policy and properly protecting it in living memory. So I say the argument against the Greenbelt has been lost. You had your chance to persuade your champions in government and you failed. It's time for think tanks and developers to get with the programme. Get development moving on brownfield sites. People want to protect their Greenbelt. So I say hands off our Greenbelt. Thank you very much.
Next up we have Nick Fox, founder of Urbed and one of the winners of the Walton Prize last year. And again, 15 minutes once he's found his slides.
Yes. Right. I've called my little contribution Greening the Greenbelt because whilst I sympathise with the overall value of the Greenbelt, I do think there are other reasons why people are concerned about greenness. And how do I get into...
Go into slideshow.
Why can't I see slideshow? Ah, yes.
Yeah, that's what
yeah. And some of you may recognise this image, which came from a winning submission, where we did indeed propose that you could double the size of historic cities like Oxford without intruding into either the floodplains or into areas of natural beauty. I'm going to talk a bit about why we think in certain situations a review is needed. I'm going to talk about some options to thinking about the Greenbelt and then six principles for what I call smarter growth and how one could overcome the Greenbelt. So why review the Greenbelt? Well, the arguments have been well put by economists like Paul Cheshire that there is a cost to the Greenbelt in certain situations and that economic growth is continuing to be an issue because of the need to try and increase productivity in the places where there's real potential. But there's also an issue about well-being. And I was really struck when I did some work for Groundwork in the west of London by how miserable large areas of the Greenbelt actually are. They're nothing like people might imagine from the name. And I just don't believe that it's just about stopping urban sprawl, because most people think of green as having a lot of values apart from preventing coalescence. Now, it is true that the housing crisis in some places is at a level where people think something's got to be done to deal with a situation where house prices are some 15 times average income. And not everywhere has the brownfield land which can provide for that housing. When the Greenbelt was first considered in the 1930s, it was because middle-class people drove along the new arterial roads and were appalled by the ugliness of the housing that was being built, the semis that sprawled all over our land. And they said something must be done to stop it. So that's where this origin of stopping sprawl came from. It was, if you like, a concern about prettiness, but the prettiness of having a fixed boundary to our cities. I think the challenges now for Britain and countries like it are very different. They're above all the issues of congestion as people drive ever further to get to work. There are issues about pollution, particularly in our cities, as the air quality diminishes and noise increases. Some will be concerned about carbon emissions as well. There are a whole series of challenges that are more than just the aesthetic concerns of the middle classes. Development economics is important because if we're going to double the housing output, as most people would like to see, we have to find a way of funding it. And at the moment, the price you pay for land with planning permission basically rules out development on any scale. So I believe that smarter growth, where we focus development around the places with accessibility, could win through. And one of the bizarre things about the Greenbelts, which has been stressed before by Tim Marshall, is how extraordinarily different they are. And in some places, they are very wide in relationship to the size of a city, like Oxford. In some places, they're much narrower. And on that alone, I think that the argument for looking seriously at the value is undeniable. I was struck, having been asked to speak in both Norwich and Exeter, that the cities don't seem that much worse because they haven't got a greenbelt. And I think that one should think again about the rhetoric that somehow it's essential to preserving our quality of life. What other options are there? Well, the green grid, which has been promoted in areas like South East London, the green fingers concept of Copenhagen, the green heart in Holland around the Randstad, or the green wilderness, the idea that French landscape architects now are promoting, the idea of bringing the country into the town, which was very much what Ebenezer Howard wanted to get at when he wanted to see town and country look together. And finally, the sort of smart growth idea, which has been promoted particularly in the States, of developing in areas which are highly accessible by transport. So these are the options, and just to bring out the fact that there is more than one way of skinning a cat. Leiden, by the way, Oxford's twin city, is somewhere like there, and you can see that there are indeed extensions going in on the edge of the Green Heart. But when they allow development in the Green Heart, they make sure that the value is then reinvested in greening the Greenbelt. They don't just allow a free fall. So how would historic cities benefit if we... if we had a different approach? Well, I think we'd get a greener, pleasanter, healthier setting. We'd have environmental benefits. I think we'd achieve social justice, one concern for some people in our society, because homes would become more affordable. I think, above all, we would all appreciate if travel times were cut and people weren't spending 2 or 3 hours a day having to get to work. And that would lead, I believe, to actually better jobs. People on low income would be able to spend more time and spend less money on transport. And finally, it would help cities like Oxford to sustain their university because it wouldn't be suffering in competition with others. So the Ooster idea was this notion of doubling the city without actually hurting the environment. And if one wants to do that, I think a number of things have to change. It won't be just business as usual. And these principles, I believe, could be acceptable to all political parties. What are they? First, you have to have sub-regional spatial strategies, as there is now in Cambridge. You have to look at the area as a whole and decide where to grow and where not to grow. And you have to have some means of enabling that plan to be implemented. And I think there's a few better examples than Peterborough Newtown, where the Nene Valley was developed as a park in between the different settlements, and as a result of developing that new town, the existing population got a real benefit in dealing with what would otherwise be a flooded area. They got a whole lot of money too that was put into improving the shopping centre. But that means you've got to be able to assemble land at its existing use value plus. And one of the advantages of development corporations, which we're proposing, is that you can do just that with very minor modifications to the principles for land valuation. If you can get hold of land at existing use value plus, there's enough in it, as Paul Cheshire has particularly pointed out, to be able to fund really first-class infrastructure. And one can then borrow against that, as they do in the States, in places like Portland, to put in improved local infrastructure. I think I've used up less than my 15 minutes. So I'm just going to finish by saying I do hope that in a city as clever as Oxford, there will be an attempt to look at more than one option, and particularly to think of what would happen if one could concentrate development in the places that are highly accessible. If you go to Holland, which is not so different, other than they believe that man made the landscape rather than God, you will see that they have a policy of focusing development in the places which are most accessible. And that is a common sense approach to life, to build around places which are natural hubs, where you've got decent public transport and good roads. And it seems to me, rather than saying the development shouldn't happen at all or should happen in Manchester or whatever, just making the most of your inherent accessibility makes common sense. And it would be good to see whether the mass of people might go along with those arguments in the situation we now face over the next few years. Thank you.
That's all. We have Tom from the Adam Smith Institute. Just to give you an idea about how interesting this debate is getting, I was on Radio South Korea yesterday. We think the president of the Adam Smith Institute, who I never thought I would be talking with on the subject, at least in a slightly friendly way. So this really is a debate that is now worldwide. It is popping up. It is not just here. All yours.
Thank you. Nick, can I have your leftover minutes? Right, yeah, thanks very much. So, yeah, I'm here to talk about the Adam Smith Institute report, The Green Noose, which we published late last year. The aim of it was basically to conduct a critical review of Greenbelt policy to ask whether we need urban containment policies at all, whether Greenbelts are justified in their own terms, and also whether popular support for the Greenbelts is justified. The paper doesn't make detailed proposals, it doesn't solve all the challenges of urban planning, and it does unashamedly concentrate on housing. So let's start with what we all already know. There's 13 million hectares of land in England, of which only 9% has been developed. By comparison, 13% of it is greenbelt. It's worth remembering that of that 9% that's been developed, about half is actually back gardens. More than 20% of England is areas of outstanding natural beauty and national parks. The greenbelts are twice the size of the cities they're protecting. They have doubled in size since 1979. These are not belts by any conceivable sense of the word. There is about four times as much land under the heaviest protections in the UK as there is land that's been developed. It's interesting that Tim pointed out earlier that there are sort of vast swathes of land that, of course, aren't protected by the Green Belt. Many of them, however, have areas of outstanding natural beauty or Green Belts or other protections, national parks or other protections. So the Green Belt is only one way of protecting land. It's probably worth tackling a couple of myths early on. One of them is that Britain is a particularly densely populated country. It is higher than the EU average, but it's no more densely populated than Germany. It's no more densely populated than Italy. It's substantially less densely populated than, say, the Belgium or Netherlands or Japan or Korea. Also, there's a myth that the UK is heavily built up. Actually, it's not far above the EU average. It's much less heavily developed than, say, Belgium or the Netherlands or Germany. And interestingly, the level of development per person is the third lowest in the EU after Cyprus and the Netherlands, which are far more densely populated. In effect, what we do in the UK is we cram the existing population into a much smaller space within the country than they do in other countries. So I said we looked at both the Green Belt in its own terms and popular support for it. If we look at the five reasons... Oh, sorry, yes, I just touched upon this. This is an interesting statistic. Basically, one in 10 people think in the UK think that over three quarters of the UK has been built over. 63% think that more than one quarter has been built over. In fact, it's less than a tenth. So there was a massive misperception, and I think that's probably because people are so densely populated within the cities. So the reasons why the Green Belt exists, well, safeguarding the countryside from encroachment depends very much on an artificial distinction between what we mean by urban and what we mean by rural. In fact, a lot of what we see as rural is itself a man-made landscape. The main purpose was originally to defend agricultural land, which is a totally outdated concept, bearing in mind that the much smaller importance of agriculture to our economy nowadays. I remember that sitting on a planning committee in the London Borough of Bromley, where Bromley councillors decided to turn down an application to build a stable for a horse next to a lady's cottage. They felt that a stable for a horse was unfitting for the rural idyll that is the Greenbelt. Checking the unrestrained sprawl of large built-up areas. Even the concept of sprawl is an entirely loaded term. It kind of gives the image of a teenager kind of lying on a sofa. There are actually countless definitions of sprawl. There is no agreed definition of sprawl. In the UK, we tend to think of it as the ever-accreting swathes of semi-detached housing. In the US, it actually refers to leapfrog development, which is something which the Greenbelt actually encourages. Another definition is that it refers to inefficient low-density land use, which is almost a definition of the Greenbelt. And I think it's fair to say that one man's sprawl is another man's house. I was born and lived in the London Borough of Harrow. If the Green Belt had been introduced 20 years earlier, that the London Borough of Harrow would never have existed. So there's a nice quick quote here from Richard Peisner. The term urban sprawl is used loosely to refer to all that is bad about urban growth and narrowly to describe specific aspects of urban growth which are considered undesirable. I'm not going to read the whole thing because it will be a bit tedious. I lump the next two together, preserving the setting of special character of historic towns and preventing neighbouring towns from merging. Because they're basically the same thing, but preventing towns from merging basically is to try to prevent the natural development of towns and cities. If you think of how Manchester or Birmingham or London emerged, they emerged by the slow merging of villages and towns. And indeed, I think it's fair to say that villages like Highgate and Dulwich and Pinner and Walthamstow are part of the character of London, of one of the things that makes it so great. I do accept the point about protecting historic towns and protecting the viscera of historic towns, but that could be done with a much narrower belt than the vast swathes of land which are currently around those towns. The last one is assisting in urban regeneration by encouraging and recycling derelict use of urban land. It's a bit of a hangover from the early and mid-20th century eras of slum clearances and post-war reconstruction. And it's worth noting that it was a total failure. The inner cities were utterly hollowed out in the 25 years after the Green Belt was introduced. It also relied very heavily on people being allowed to live somewhere else, and that was the new towns. We haven't commissioned a new town since 1970. And as a consequence, and if you think there's going to be a bun fight over green belts, wait till the government starts pointing on a map and saying that's where the new town's going to go. So those are the official reasons, but those aren't really the reasons that most people give when they like the Green Belt. Most people, Paul Cheshire quote, but I'll probably skip it again. Most people support the Green Belt for two reasons. One, they think it gives access to green space to urban populations. Two, they think it's environmentally valuable. The first is, they're both incorrect. The amenity of value of green space decreases rapidly over distance. Studies from around the world suggest that green space ceases to have any measurable amenity value after about a 1 mile distance. This is from the Barker Review, it shows that the benefits we derive from the Green Belt is far smaller than the benefits we derive from urban core public space, and yet urban core public space is put under pressure because of urban containment policies. Crystal Palace Park, where I used to be a councillor, had 180 houses approved on the parkland because we were protecting fields full of sheep in the south of the borough. The Green Belt is also highly regressive. Access to the Green Belt correlates with house prices and thus with income, as a consequence of which what it does is it protects plentiful green space around rich people while putting the small amount of green space near poorer people under greater threat. The green belts aren't particularly green, at least not in the sense of being environmentally beneficial. Around a third is intensive agricultural land. This has low biodiversity. It generates negative environmental effects. The green belts also cause a reduction in the size of urban gardens and urban green space, which have very good environmental standards. Just ask the RSPB. Interestingly, because it encourages leapfrog development as people have to build beyond the green belt, what you actually get is longer commutes, pushing up carbon emissions, and you get more extensive rail and road network, which means more land is concreted over. There are also, that seemed to go backwards, definite welfare costs of the Green Belt, which somebody referred to earlier. Firstly, real house prices in the UK have increased 3.5 times since 1955. Neither Germany, which is as densely populated as Britain, nor the Netherlands, which is far more densely populated, has seen this level of house price rise. They've both had very flat prices. This is a massive welfare cost to British citizens. When people talk about a cost of living crisis, the second biggest thing people pay after their tax bill is their accommodation, and this is why. 25 years ago, Anthony Evans described modern British housing as rabbit hutches built on postage stamps. We are packing households into ever smaller spaces. A new house in the Netherlands is 38% larger than a new house in the UK. A new house in Germany is 40% larger. A new house in Denmark is 100% larger. And I feel that what we are ending up with is a situation where we are expecting the next generation to live in smaller, older, more cramped accommodation than we did, which seems to be a very strange approach to human development. It also exaggerates house price volatility. A recent academic study found an unambiguous causal evidence demonstrating that regulatory supply constraints have increased house price volatility. House price volatility in the UK is far higher than it is in other parts of the world, and this causes major macroeconomic crises, not least recessions. There is also an increased cost of business premises, which I'd like to do more work on, but it's fair to say that constrained business premises means higher rents, means higher prices, it means a greater reliance, or alternatively a greater reliance on imports, which impacts on jobs. And may very well have impacted upon the decline of manufacturing in the UK. The environmental and welfare costs, I think we've touched on before. Lastly, to say that there's also a huge missed opportunity. If we can get to the 150,000 a year extra houses that we are going that we need to build, that would create 750,000 more jobs. At a time they're perfectly suited to some of the people who didn't do too well at school and who are currently languishing on the unemployment benefit. So what are our proposals for reform? Well, the first is what I call abolish and protect. Abolish green belts entirely as a designation because they are no longer fit for purpose. Redesignate any genuinely valuable land, be it environmentally or for amenity space, under another classification. There are plenty. AOSBs, SSSIs, Ramsar sites, woodland, ancient woodland. The OECD says that green belts constitute a major obstacle to development around cities where housing is often needed. Replacing green belts by land use restrictions that better reflect environmental designations would free up land for housing while preserving the environment. The second would be just to declassify all the intensive agricultural land. This is the stuff where they've sterilised all the life out of it and they now grow rapeseed. I can see no economic value in growing rapeseed in London boroughs between Woodford and Romford. That is a very bad use of land. Just bear with me a second. That would free up 500,000 hectares of land, 40% of all the developed space in the UK. it would still leave the green belts larger than in 1979, and only a tiny fraction of that would actually need to be built on. Perhaps 4.5% of that land, actually 1.5% of the green belt, would enable us to build 1 million extra homes. However, the last one is just a tiny revision. You simply take the agricultural land that is within 10 minutes walk of an existing railway station in London's Greenbelt, and you just take that out. And with that, you could find enough room for 1 million houses. So in summary, the UK is not overpopulated or overdeveloped. The official justification for Greenbelts is based on dubious assumptions. Greenbelts do not deliver what people believe they deliver. We should abolish them. We should protect the genuinely important sites, and we should build 1 million extra homes by 2025. Thank you.
If all our speakers could come up to the front now. We have got plenty of time, we've got 50 minutes. I'll just tell you a very short story while they're all getting ready. I went to school in a school next door to here called Taylor. So my knowledge of this place is where you could sneak in and get to the poly bar if you looked 16 and a half at the time. One of my memories is that the very nice lady who cooked us lunch every day, and her kids went to school. The school's changed a lot. There was only one Don's child when I went. There are now numerous associate professors' children now. But I think the big difference now is there will still probably be a lady, but the lady who's cooking the food there, her children won't go to the school because she can't have children. This is my abiding worry. Is Oxford changing into a place which is filling up, if you like, with servants? People who can work here, just about fit in here, but can never dream of having a family here. And I'll just leave you with that. Can we take questions in pairs and keep them short, and I'll make sure that the answers that you get back are short? One pair and one pair.
Thank you. I'm John Goddard. For most of the last 20 years, I've been a local councillor. I stood down, I wasn't defeated, I stood down a year ago. In 2000, I became chair of the planning committee, and I've sat on planning committees for the next 16 years. So I'm concerned about Oxford's people. People need homes, jobs, and healthy schools, cultural facilities nearby. These currently are denied to the people in Oxford, as our chairman has just pointed out. They are denied to many people who already live in the city, and they are denied totally to those who wish to work in the city, either because they think it's a good place to live, which it certainly is, or because they wish to contribute to its economy, which they are needed to do. So the answer is to develop around the existing facilities, isn't it? Thank you. Do you agree? Do you agree?
Okay.
So,
could I leave the panel to think about this?
Could I ask the panel to think about the five functions? Two of the speakers have put them up. And how they might amend them. The first three, which were Duncan Sands' original 1955 policy on Greenbelt, check the unrestricted sprawl of large built-up areas, prevent neighbouring towns merging into one another, and to assist in safeguarding the countryside from encroachment, still stand the time, test of time. I think Matt Thompson's probably right that the assisting means other parts of the countryside be safeguarded in other ways. So it may be it's because you also need agriculture to safeguard the countryside. You can't just do it by rebuilt policy. The fourth was, and the fifth, were introduced in 1984 as a result of the government's attempt at one time to undermine the bill. The first one, which is very relevant here, preserve the setting and the special character of historic towns. Some might say, well, they've already been undermined by growth around them, but Bath particularly has benefited Oxford, others may have a view. If I was changing it, I would add in historic villages, because that role is really a long-term long-term consequence of the 1967 Civic Amenities Act and creation of conservation areas.
Any question?
Well, I want to ask, and I'll just ask what, whether you would add to these, because the fifth one, which is the most important really, which as CPO has said, to assist in urban regeneration, encouraging the recycling of derelict and other urban land. So it also encourages recycling of older development, not derelict. What it doesn't include at the moment is any purpose of sustainability, which might or might not be a good thing, or any aim of assisting modal shift by encouraging people to travel by train into town rather than by car. But I leave that with you, probably don't have any views now, but I do think the five functions are important, and if you were changing them, the only one I'd change is adding villages, but others may have better.
Comment about villages in relationship to character. I think that if you ask people about what their concern is in terms of the quality of the environment, which as I tried to emphasize was an early concern of the region, it was the look of things. I think the look of villages in their setting is a really important concern. Because we have a not very proactive planning system, because it tends to respond to developers going where it's easiest. The natural tendency is to focus development around the small villages, where there's a field on the edge and so on. And so the natural process of things will be to leave the difficult sites, the brownfield sites, however hard you make the development, you'll leave those to the end and you'll focus where you can get permission on the edge. Now, in my view, what one should be doing is having a in areas where there's green belt, a very clear trade-off. One would say, in return for concentrating development in the areas that are highly accessible by public transport, we will make it very difficult to be able to develop in the other areas in the green belt, except where there's local support through neighbourhood plans or whatever. So I would bring in much greater protection. We worked out that for the 246 villages which are considered to be fine villages in Oxfordshire, some 26 would be affected by the proposals for doubling the population of Oxford, which is quite a big expectation. So that in fact you could actually have a much greater safeguard on the quality of what I think most people would value if you got back to the roots of what the whole proposal, the whole thinking of the Green Belt was about. So yes, let's modify, let's bring in your protection for villages as well as towns, but let's bring in this new factor, which is accessibility by alternatives to the car, because that, as we look ahead, is going to be the key consideration if we're not to be stuck in traffic jams forevermore.
Thank you. I did raise so many things I'm trying to keep in my head at once, but with regard to villages, I think largely villages are well served by green belt protection. But there is a question of whether this idea that Nicholas has just proposed, that if you allow a certain amount of intensive development, well-located and sustainable and so on, within the green belt, with the promise of even greater protection of the green belt, which I think it's been argued is the greatest protection possible.
I meant the villages in the green fields outside the green belt would be protected. Not just in the green.
But how could people possibly take the promise of greater protection when they've seen their green belt eroded by development, when no development should have taken place in the green belt in the first place? I think as soon as you start talking about increasing protection for places inside or outside the green belt as a trade-off for development in the green belt, why would anybody ever want to believe you that that protection would stick up? It just defeats me.
Firstly, to your point, I mean, I as I said in my presentation, I agree that there is a case for protecting the visual aspects of ancient towns, historic towns and villages. I just don't think it needs the vast sway to green belt that has at the moment. If you had genuinely narrow belts, you could protect that imagery. Nick raises the point about driving people, trying to develop this to prioritise brownfield. we need to remember the government does have brownfield first targets that have been exceeded massively every time. I mean,
84%.
84% of development is already in brownfield. So the idea
sorry,
that...
That's out of date. The government doesn't have brownfield targets anymore. And those brownfield targets aren't being met.
Well, but historically they have. And the idea that our green space is being massively chipped away by development is simply a myth. But I noticed that nobody's actually addressed John's question, which was, where are the people who, be it Oxford or any other town, where are the people who want to come here, to live here, to work here, to contribute to what is a growing, successful, thriving city supposed to live? Do you really want a sort of situation where this is the metropolitan centre with its huge opportunity for growth and for high quality production and jobs? Do you really want the people who have to come here to commute from huge distances, with usually accompanied with massive carbon emissions because they're usually driving to the big park and ride up the A40, because they can't afford a house here because it's 10 or 15 times the average income? That is not a sustainable way forward, and it is threatening. It will threaten to throttle the life out of cities like Oxford.
I mean, I'll just maybe respond quickly to that point, but also on the functions issue. Can I just restate my view on the current Greenbelt situation? I'm fairly sort of immobilist. I think leave it as it is and make it work properly. And in that sense, I agree with Matt because it's being broken left, right, and centre at the moment. Well, I don't know why CPRE wants to depend on the wishes, the promises of Cameron and others, when they've clearly not been coming up with the goods the last 3 years since the NPPF was put in place. So I think they're being a bit naive, if you like, to depend on that. But as far as the functions are concerned, I think they're fine. They should be stuck to for the moment. My idea is that in the long term, you should completely review that. You should, if you like, start with a clean slate and think about what countryside should really be used for. And I don't think we can do that in a short period of time. So it's not a matter of making a rapid change to the existing proposals, but we could improve the NPPF very considerably by making it more planning and person friendly rather than so obsessed with economic gain in the short run.
Any more questions?
Sorry, just come back. In a minute, we're going to let the audience maybe very good. lady at the front and the man right from that. That's you.
Yeah. Hi, I'm Alice Ross from Cheltenham. Am I sounding all right? Can you
hear me? The microphone needs to be near the mouth when you're using it.
Testing. Yeah.
Thank you. I'm Alice Ross from Cheltenham. At the moment, strategy with Gloucester and Chipsworth and Cheltenham is just going into EIP, and we have 11,000 houses proposed for various areas of the Greenbelt between Cheltenham and Gloucester, which seems rather a lot to us. One particular one I'm campaigning against is for 5,000 houses all in a great swamp beside Cheltenham, adding up to another quarter to Cheltenham's population over the next years, and completely without, as far as we can see, any infrastructure possibilities, and certainly not with good transport facilities into Cheltenham. At the moment, there is one junction on the M5 going up north, it doesn't go down south, so everyone leaving there to go south to work will have to go right through Cheltenham. It sounds to us as though it's not going to be feasible, but still we seem to be going ahead. And I think that sounds to me like one of these ones which should not happen because the transport system and the infrastructure are not appropriate. So what do you think about that? Should we just go ahead with it?
Right. And the man back there with the mic...
Chris Cousins from Oxford. I agree very much with Tim Marshall that there are a lot of interconnected issues here. And it seems to me some of the discussion has risked laying at the door of the Greenbelt a lot of other societal ills. But both Nicholas Falk and Tim have suggested that land value capture is a very significant part of any possible successful future development in the Greenbelt. I'd like to ask speakers, perhaps particularly Tom Tapworth, whether they agree with that as a process, given that politicians from Winston Churchill through to Lord Wilson advocated it. And secondly, I think that without that, there's a lot of hope being put in the idea that somehow just releasing land in the Greenbelt will result in a trickle-down benefit to people, which I personally very much doubt. And I would just like to ask people how much they think it would reduce house prices in Oxford if, say, 10,000 new houses were to be built in the Oxford Greenbelt without any other measures.
Short answer to the last question is not one jot. All the evidence shows that the houses that are proposed to be built on Greenbelt on the edge of towns and cities across the UK tend to be large, detached or semi-detached houses with gardens. Although that might be what people aspire to, they also aspire to a Ferrari and a yacht. Nobody's talking about a yacht crisis. Hopefully we should provide people with affordable yachts. I want to come back just quickly on what was said earlier. But first of all, CPRE aren't relying on the fact that Tories have been elected to ensure that Greenbelt policy is enforced properly. Obviously, that will take a lot more work. And I'd also like to come back on this idea, the question of where people should live if they're wanting to move to a place like Oxford that's growing and expanding, yada, yada, yada. And my first question would be, strategic planning is all about saying, is this the right place for growth? Does it have the opportunities to meet the need for development in that area? Is there actually a need for development in that area? Or is it just, as is the case in Oxford, the aspirations of an unelected local enterprise partnership is driving it? So when we're planning for the future of areas like Oxford, the starting point should be what the constraints are operating in that area, and how could that development be met within the existing urban area and the existing urban areas of places that are well connected to the centre of Oxford. And actually Oxfordshire is an incredibly well connected county, thanks to the enlightened county towns policy that's been operating for decades.
We have one microphone down here, if that's possible. Yeah, particularly since we've got Eastern Town Cheltenham, the swamp of 5,000 houses.
I do think the lady put her finger on it, that for most people, sustainability is about reconciling infrastructure and development, and that does require a degree of analysis and judgment, and so that we shouldn't have just a general principle of growth or no growth, but we should be looking at the circumstances. And I don't know enough about, well, I shouldn't know enough, because I live in Stroud, so it goes to Cheltenham. But it seems to me we've got to get away from this notion that that development is driven by landowners or developers coming up with ideas to which local authorities react, and to have some form of strategic planning where we look at the bigger picture, because the resources available for infrastructure are very limited, the level of investment and so on. So not only do we not want to waste places where there are opportunities for sustainable development, but we certainly don't want to impose development on places where there won't be the funds to either pay for improved roads or public transport or for schools. That's, to my mind, an idea that should win general support, and I call it smarter growth. I mean, it's just being intelligent about development. And
It'd be quite interesting, actually, Chairman, may I suggest that at the end of this debate, it'd be quite interesting to see the views of people here about these alternatives. Because in no way would I suggest an overall abandonment of the Greenbelt. I think it's neither politically possible, nor would it be a prudent thing to do. But it is what I'm arguing for is a different approach to planning and development that would allow in certain situations for growth to go ahead.
What I might do at the end, because we've got 35 minutes, is let each speaker make one suggestion and then we'll put a show of hands as to whether you like it or not, to get an idea. But let's have 30 more minutes of debate, you can make up your mind first.
I would just add more or less agreement with much of Nicholas's point, but I think in Cheltenham, which is a serious planning exercise because there's three districts involved and there's a serious green belt review, if you like, not just one done just on the back of an envelope type of thing. If you are pressing up against the limits of the system does not provide infrastructure, the system does not resolve land value capture. And I would like to see in some sort of way, a revolt by people in those areas who are suffering from a lousy system. They should try and build up some pressure on the current government to provide the conditions that make it worthwhile for them to have this extra development. Otherwise, I think there should be a sort of right to say no, because if the land value system's not being sorted out, if proper affordable housing isn't being sorted out, then why should people have it? So I think there should be a fight going on, really. And the trouble is, we get into these sort of debates of everybody stopping and everybody getting in a sort of complete conflict situation. So.
Thank you. Firstly, I think you're entirely right that it's very important that the infrastructure and the transport is got right first. No one is saying there shouldn't be master planning of big developments, but what we're saying is that there shouldn't be a blanket prohibition on developments where there is a clear demand. The gentleman earlier mentioned land value capture. I think that's a very interesting issue. And I did say in my presentation that obviously this was a focus on one particular issue, but Tim's right, they're all closely interconnected. In a report I'm bringing out later this week with my through Centre Forum, which is another think tank with which I'm affiliated, among other recommendations, I'm specifically going to recommend that a Royal Commission be set up to look at the taxation of property and specifically the taxation of land. But I should also give a plug to our hosts here. I think the Royal Town Planning Institute are also about to undertake a similar review. They'll be getting an expert panel together to look at this because it is a very important issue. There is no reason why the stroke of a planner's pen should lead to somebody making £100 million windfall. I do just want to pick up on some of Matt's comments though, because I found them frankly a bit bizarre. Firstly, you talk about, nobody's talking about a yacht crisis. You may have noticed a yacht is not an essential of life. Housing is one of life's essentials. And frankly, if the price of food has gone up 3.5 times in the last 50 years, you'd have had riots. I mean, these people want space to live, and it doesn't make sense that you're cramming them into ever smaller housing. And the idea that increasing supply...
You're not cramming people into ever smaller housing. It's the developers that have been building ever smaller housing for decades.
The developers are building smaller houses because they have some limited amount of land they can build. And the fact is that
smaller houses...
The idea that four-bedroom houses don't affect the house prices is an absurdity. If you built 1 million Buckingham Palaces, the price of a flat would fall.
Right. Because you both have not got the mics, it wouldn't be fair. We have hands up again, please. I think you've got the mics. You're going to go first. At the front. Next time I'll take four questions, so you've got more chances. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, there's a couple of musings for the panel to comment on. After the last contribution, I have to say that the Adam Smith Institute seems to have taken exaggerating to make a point to as yet undreamed of heights. The first thing I'd like to say is that I think it's a misconception, and indeed Kate Barker in her 2008 paper said it was, that any conceivable amount of house building would bring house prices down where there was still demand. Now, it's a long and complicated reason, but let's take Kate Barker's word for it, and she's no friend of the Greenbelt, as she has recently said, albeit for other reasons. The Councillor Goddard has been instrumental in causing in Oxfordshire a 30-year debate into the merits of the Greenbelt, so I would imagine that we probably have one of the best informed publics in the world in the matter of the Greenbelt. And he says that they've been doing all this in the public interest, so we would test what the public interest actually was. It turns out that the Greenbelt is more popular in Oxfordshire, in Oxford, in every social class, homeowners and non-homeowners, than Nicola Sturgeon is in Scotland, and by a multiple of two. 76% of people throughout all classes and locations supported the continued openness of the Greenbelt over building houses in it, an informed question, and only 8% supported the project.
Right, we'll find out later whether you fit that mould. Can we have one foot at the front, please?
Thanks very much. Councillor Van Coulter, is there not a correlation between the shortage of housing in Oxford and premature deaths? My ward, Barton Sandhills, people are in poverty housing, and as a result, they're dying 8 to 10 years before their equivalent in rich North Oxford.
I think we're getting right into the Oxford passions here. It's very dangerous territory to tread into. I'm sure Danny is the person to answer on the last question as far as the relationship between housing and early death is concerned. But the housing issue is sitting in the background here quite clearly, and it seems to me the housing issue should be directly answered by the society and political forces to use Greenbelt as a proxy for dealing with that, and assuming that by getting rid of Greenbelt, as the Adam Smith Institute proposes, is going to solve the housing problem, I think is just ridiculous. The Adam Smith Institute has its own ideological agenda, as we know, there's no secret. You look at their website, they're quite clear about their approach, and they're really not. They don't have multiple objectives in the way that you would have as a councillor for the welfare of your people, as it were. They brought us fast deregulation, they brought us rail privatisation, they brought us internal markets in hospitals and schools. So I'm not saying Tom is responsible for this, I'm just saying that is the position of Adam Smith Institute as an organisation. And I think we need to be slightly questioning if somebody like that is proposing Greenbelt abolition. Perhaps we all ought to be in favour of keeping the Greenbelt, just as an automatic reflex.
I think the issue you're raising is the one of the imbalance or polarisation, which is a natural trend of leaving things to the free market. And if you do that, as Oxford knows full well, you end up with riots from time to time. So it's in people's general interest to try to create a more balanced society in which people feel there is some hope of progress, which can include access to housing. And therefore, for that reason alone, I think providing large enough sites to be able to restructure areas, again, happens in Holland as a matter of course, or Germany or whatever, in which we've lost sight of. So I do think that as well as the environmental imperative of reducing congestion, there is also a social imperative of creating a better balance, which is in everyone's interest, because it will create a more stable society, and its margin, I think, will reduce the tendency for people to riot or throw bombs.
But I probably should have exercised, I should exercise the right to reply. I think I should start by saying that
that the I should start by saying the Adam Smith Institute has an agenda that that is by and large we should allow markets to function because we believe people know what's in their own best interest and they should be free to pursue it. And the idea that there is a free market in currency is ludicrous. The 1947 Town and Country Planning Act nationalised development rights. You do not have the right to develop your own land. And as a consequence, there is not a free market in planning and housing. There is a locally government-regulated market in housing and planning. And I think that is having effects, like it's preventing the building of new and better housing, which means those who are trapped in substandard housing are feeling the not only the welfare effect, but the health effect. I really do think that it is having an effect. So you know, I am quite happy to stand by the Adam Smith Institute's position, which is that people should be free to solve the problems that they in society face without the dead hand government preventing them from doing it.
Two things that I'd like to say. First of all, that I think a lot of the things that have just been talked about reflect a position that was made earlier, which is that a lot of the ills in society that Tom particularly has been talking about have been laid at the door of Greenbelt, and only Greenbelt, it seems, rather than all the other factors that are called into play there. And I think, yes, it's terrible that people living in certain parts of Oxford have a lower or a higher mortality rate or than in other parts of rural Oxfordshire. And if that is because they're living in substandard housing, then that is something that obviously needs to be addressed. But the fact that houses have not been built in many of the locations that they could have been built in that doesn't affect the Green Belt, and that is a failure of the house building industry and the market as much as it is a failure of the Green Belt, if not more so. Particularly as it's the house building industry that are building these substandard houses and the private rented sector that are failing to improve the substandard houses that they're renting to these people, etc., etc., really shows that it's not just the Green Belt that's to blame. And I think that's everything I want to say.
Thank you. Okay, let's take four very quick questions, so please keep them short. Man at the back first. Sorry. Yeah. I'll hold it within. Lady in the front, sorry. Let's give you a short walk. Lady in the front, then the man at the back.
Hello, I'm Dr. Catherine Kay. I have a degree from Oxford in geography and a deep field. Our department at one time. I sat through all of the Northern Gateway hearings and gave evidence about public health. And with regard to your question, part of the problem that the people you represent suffer from is traffic pollution, is that when you are next to or in close proximity to roads and particulate matter, particularly PM2.5 and nitrogen oxide, which we know in Oxford is beyond legal limits, then there will be direct effects on pregnant women and on their fetuses, on the babies, on the children, and on the old people, because there are lifetime problems to do with air pollution and the proximity of your population to traffic. However, what I really want to know from all of the panelists is, have any of you heard of climate change? And do you think that there is a natural capital to be found in the Greenbelt with regard to climate change resilience, which is a requirement of the 2008 Climate Change Act? Thank you.
Good question. Hey, down the back. We're
going
to take two more nearby, then I'll do this side afterwards.
Thank you, Martin. I hold the view that the Green Belt is out of date, not really fit for purpose anymore. I also hold the view that the Green Belt is a blunt planning tool that was put in place at a point in time. It seems to me there's plenty more appropriate planning tools for addressing and dealing with the environment. And development and planning control. Do you agree with me that the use of Greenbelt policy now is really just a lazy planning tool?
Okay. Anybody else on this side? the man that's in front of you and the man with the pink t-shirt.
Hi, I'm
Sam Stafford from Barrett Development. I'm Sam Stafford from Barrett Development. One of the reasons that we don't build enough homes is because there aren't enough local plans allocating enough lands. And two of the reasons there aren't enough local plans allocating enough land are the absence of a strategic planning layer, which has been touched upon, and the blunt tool that is the duty to cooperate, and the size and scale of the objective assessment of housing needs and how large and scary that could be, and the fact that that isn't a material consideration to justify the release of the Greenbelt, as Matt pointed out at the start. Those two things are, I would contend, a direct consequence of public opinion. Strategic planning is top-down, and objectively assessed housing needs are enforced. If my question to the panel is, if the current housing crisis isn't sufficient to justify a remedy to those two problems currently, how bad would the panel suggest it has to be before it is, and how can public opinion be turned before we get there?
Thank you.
And the last question.
Thank you. I work for a local authority with like 94% greenbelt land. Our urban areas are full. Our local authorities next to us don't want to meet our need. And we're outside of the scope of being able to come up with these sort of broader strategic sort of planning ideas. At the same time, we obviously can't abolish our greenbelt. So in the interim, what do you think we can do to meet the sustainable development needs of residents of our district, particularly young people who can't afford to live here? So I'd be interested in your views.
Can we ask which authority?
It's in Surrey.
Say no more.
Okay, who wants to go first this time?
I think of something. Well, now I've got the microphone in my hand. I mean, I'm thinking about climate change questions. It seems to me it refers, at the very least, to the bigger questions we ought to be thinking about whenever we consider land use change on a big scale, which we ought to be thinking about on a big scale. I don't know exactly what the implications would be if we started looking at the whole of the Oxfordshire region in relation to climate change, and I think there will be serious implications, and you could use some of the green belt as a sort of improvement, I don't know, sinks. There's all sorts of phrases among the climate change specialists. On the other three questions, which are all specific planning instrument type questions, or when will the housing crisis get bad enough, or what does a very constrained local authority do? They're all tough questions, I'm sorry to say. The planning tools we've got are very dumbed down, blunted by poor management of the planning system by politicians over the last 10 or 15 years, in my view. And it's very difficult to make the system work. So I think you need a very improved system. I mean, I don't envy the local authority planners or the house builders. They're working in a very suboptimal situation, which... having to sort of pull levers which don't work, they're rubbery, they just, everybody's in a situation which is rather sort of tangled and wearying and hair pulling out. And so, you know, I can't give easy answers to those.
So again, so much to cover. First of all, on climate change, yes, the Greenbelt has natural capital, CPRE hasn't forgotten climate change. We work very hard on it. If you want to find out about the natural capital relating to Greenbelt, please read Dieter Helm's recent report and other things that he said about natural capital. One of the best things about Greenbelt is that it encourages the development of sustainable, walkable neighbourhoods, which has to be a good thing, not just for climate change, but also for reducing particulate emissions and helping to improve health of people locally. Yes, we need more homes, and strategic planning was a good way of helping to make sure those homes happened, and getting local plans in place is very important in terms of getting those homes delivered. And I would say to Barrett's and to any other developer present,
stop frustrating the adoption of development plans by continually objecting to them, let them get in place. Then when you've got your planning permissions, build the houses you've got planning permission for as quickly as you can, instead of drip feeding them and keeping house prices artificially inflated.
Thank you. Yes, I mean, I completely agree we should be focusing on climate change. One of the things we should be concerned with is a policy which encourages leapfrog development and causes people to have to drive 40 miles to work in the morning.
People, and the same.
I mean, we should be people moving from Oxford to London, because London can't grow now either. We should be encouraging people to be able to live within cycling distance of where they
work.
That is not my living near as London that I cycle to work. So, I mean, I think it is entirely important. And this talk of sustainable, walkable neighbourhoods, there is simply no evidence that large numbers of people are going and using the green belt for walking. It's a tiny amount. Well, okay, fair enough. The gentleman at the back referred to the green belt as a planning tool. Yes, that's exactly what it is. It was designed as a planning tool, and it has come to be an impediment to good planning. The gentleman who asked how bad does the housing crisis have to get. I'm reminded of the story about how boiling a frog, because it's cold blooded. So if you put it in the water and slowly boil it, you can boil it. And we are slowly boiling a frog here. However, it is impacting on the cost of living crisis, and we are seeing increasingly people falling into poverty. And I repeat what I said in my presentation: housing is the second biggest expense that people have after paying their tax bill, and our housing is 3.5 times as expensive as that in Germany or that in the Netherlands. They have better planning systems, and the point is well made. This isn't really just a greenbelt issue. This is really a planning policy issue. We have got our planning policy wrong. This is just a subset of it. We have got our planning policy wrong in this country, and the consequence is that we do not build enough houses. And finally, to that, the gentleman said, where do you go if you can't build out? Well, you can always build up. But my understanding is Oxford also has a blue grid.
Are you asking for the final points?
We've got about 15 minutes left. Okay, on this side now. Have we got the mic?
Yeah.
Lady at the back, please, first.
Yeah. We'll do four more questions, and then we'll do those, get you to vote, okay?
Hi, my name is Maria Farone. I'm from, let's say, North America. So we, know all about what green belts are for. Lots of failures with urban sprawl. But I must say, there's a little bit of an obsessiveness here with green belt. And I also think that there is no frame of reference for success. So if England is 9% developed, I'll put this to the panel. Imagine 20% developed, draw where the green belts are, keeping in mind that the people who rule England have the greatest amount of power in any rural area I've worked in.
Next question. Maybe just around here.
Yeah, hi, Ms. Reason. I always get nervous when I hear people talk about sustainable development, because it's actually a fig leaf. Lots of development goes ahead with the label sustainable development, and there is no robust definition of what that means or how it should be both implemented and regulated for, because we know that there's masses of non-compliance and it just carries on. How are we going to deal with that?
Just take these two down here. Ask two questions.
Thank you. My name is Alan Ludwig, and I'm from an organisation called the Oxford Green Belt Network, so you know what our position is. And my question is going to be about regional policy. The assumption of a lot of the people who are proposing development in the Greenbelt seems to be that Oxford should just carry on accommodating all the growth pressures which it's generating, We would argue that some of those growth pressures are genuine and some of them are very speculative indeed, such as the Northern Gateway development. Surely there is a case for spreading some of that economic growth to the rest of the country, to places where that would love the development. I mean, my family live in West Wales, and there are parts of West Wales which would love to be twinned with Oxford and actually accommodate some of that development. Now, regional policy in the past has been criticised for various reasons. Times have changed. People in Oxford could think of a very smart way, perhaps, of encouraging some sort of regional development. My final point is really that in an age where we have high-speed internet connectivity, surely distance isn't a problem for communication. So the benefits of that growth could be spread more widely across the country. I'd like to know what the panel thinks of that.
Thank you. And our final question at the front.
Thank you. Peter Thompson. Going right back to something Tim said right at the outset about national societal issues. It seems to me at the moment we've got a national health service that's in crisis. We've got an education system that is desperate for more money at every level, from primary school to universities. We've got an annual deficit of £90 billion a year. We've got a £1.4, £1.5 trillion national debt, which we're not going to pay off through further cuts in welfare benefits. We read that the Oxford Oxfordshire low carbon economy could be contributing an extra £1 billion a year to the national economy. I'd just like to ask the panel, that is it really true that the only reason that there is growth projected for central Oxfordshire because of the unfettered ambitions of an unelected local enterprise partnership? Or is it the case that we're actually in something of a national financial crisis, and we need, in the words of Michael Heseltine, to leave no stone unturned to find economic growth to actually maintain the kind of contributors to what we call civilization, which currently seem to me to be at risk?
Thank you. Okay, who's going first?
I've managed to forget what Maria's question was at the beginning. Say it briefly again.
Frame of reference for success.
What?
What's the frame of reference for success?
That really, I mean, all these four questions are big picture questions. One is about sustainable development, one's about growth and where we get our future prosperity, and I suppose the frame of reference for success is the same thing, really, is that what do we count as the point of having a green belt, or what is the point of thinking about the future of places? It seems to me, you know my own prejudices probably by now, but that the a bigger strategic view, a bigger national vision of what you want to get up to, although I shouldn't say the word vision, it sounds awful, but a national objective for greater long-term sustainable equity seems to be the way to go, and unfortunately that's not the situation we're in at the moment. We don't have a government which is interested in that set of goals, so I think for the moment we should probably try and make the existing system work as well as it can, and not make massive changes. I mean, my disrespectful comments about the Adam Smith Institute earlier, I mean, I think we should be very serious about what they publish. They will have influence on this present government. I wasn't trying to sort of run down their importance in any way, and I think we should, they were very influential in previous Conservative governments. And so we should read what they do and then take with some worries. So their big picture is not the same as the one that I'm presenting. So,
and quite quick, because we're going to need time to sum up.
When Ebenezer Howard was writing about and promoting garden cities over a century ago, it was because he wanted to reconcile the different advantages of town and country. I believe that idea of having the best of both town and country is as relevant today as ever, because the economy today is driven by knowledge workers. And knowledge workers will go to the places that offer that best balance. And it seems to me perfectly conceivable that we can achieve a much better resolution. For a start, a reference made to country parks, we could be planting masses more trees than we have at the moment. We could be soaking up the water instead of it flooding by creating, if you like, wilderness of woods or whatever. There is a whole way in which we could manage the countryside much better. And remember, the countryside is largely a managed place. It's not just a God-given place. So it seems to me the issue is about how we manage natural resources. And I think that point about natural capital is a very important one. But we shouldn't just take it for granted. Let's think whether we can't harness the potential of nature to make all our lives a bit better.
Great. We've got just 8 minutes to go if your planner's finding it difficult.
I think the frame of reference question is a very good one, actually. What is it we actually want to see? I'm kind of putting in mind of the Amartya Sen ideas of human functionings and human capabilities. But let's be blunt here. What we want to see is higher standards of living for people. And at the moment, then we have a housing crisis that is impacting upon people's standard of living. And, you know, I find it a little bit bizarre that people sweat blood and tears to save fields for fields with the odd horse in it, and they will not consider the cost on people's livelihoods of constraining housing supply. You said we currently have 9% developed. What would it be like with 20% developed? 65 million people live in that 9%. We can fit 70 million in 10%. There's no way we need to develop that much. The fact is, we're actually talking about developing a tiny proportion of the land in this country. The statistic we reckon is that that we're left. You could meet all the housing demand for the foreseeable future in about 1% of the UK. And on the issue of economic planning, and you know, shouldn't be encouraging people to trying to encourage people to go to other cities rather than where they're coming to the moment. Economic planning has never been a great success. The reason why people wanted to come to Oxford is because its great universities are spinning out great technology centres and great opportunities, and there is a big issue around what economists call agglomeration. To be productive and to be successful, we need to be near other productive and successful people. I would say we should be celebrating Oxford's success, and we should be allowing it to grow, because as the last gentleman pointed out, that is how we're going to grow our economy, that is how we're going to improve standards of living, that is how we're going to get out of the current economic doldrums.
Right, I'll be as quick as I can. 4 points. First of all, good to hear from Maria, hi. And it's great to get a North American perspective on sprawl, particularly so soon after LSE Cities have published a report showing that sprawl is costing the US economy $1 trillion a year. And that, if that isn't a frame of reference for restricting sprawl in England, I don't know what is. Spreading growth across the country, naturally, the Adam Smith Institute would be opposed to economic planning. Ignoring the fact that we already have economic planning, the government supports the overheating southeast of England with its support for measures such as a new runway in London, despite the fact that capacity in London already exceeds any other capital city in the world except for Istanbul. I don't know why it's Istanbul, but there you go. And there is capacity in existing airports in the north of England, and public spending on public transport in London is 200 times what it is in Tyneside. If that's not economic planning that affects the spatial distribution of growth in the country, I don't know what is. Finally, just wanted to pick up on something that was said about the raison d'etre at the Adam Smith Institute, claiming that everything they do is in the interest of individual liberty and supporting individual choice. Individual choices are that we have a government that makes difficult decisions on behalf of people. And one of the difficult decisions the government has made is that we should have a greenbelt. And they have good reasons for that greenbelt. And the Adam Smith Institute think that they know better than the population of the country, who A, want a government, and B, want the government to protect the greenbelt.
Okay. Right, we're going to bring it to a close. What I'm going to do is let each speaker sum up in just 30 seconds what they want to say, and if they want, give you a referendum question. Now, the rules of a referendum are very, very simple. You can only answer yes or no or abstain, and the question has to be short. But, however, just before you pose the question, you're allowed to sum up and try to influence the voters. So I'll give you just one demonstration. If we are trying to get homes for the men and women who cook the food for our children in this city, one way in which we could do it would be to leave the European Union. Because of, this isn't my view, by the way, but let's give it you anyway. A quarter of people in this city are born overseas, mostly in the European Union. Of all regions in the UK, Oxfordshire, Buckinghamshire and Berkshire receive more money from the European Science Foundation than anywhere else in the whole EU. If we can't get that money anymore, all those jobs go away, all the houses become empty again, and people can live in them again. So my question is, would you be in favour of the UK regaining sovereignty and leaving the European Union? Put up your hand if it's yes. Right, we've got a couple. Put up your hand if it's no. Right, you're not representative of the nation. Okay, so we'll start off here with Nick. Keep it short.
I'm not going to suggest a total abolition or total change in the Greenbelt. I'd just like to propose that in those circumstances where the Greenbelt review may be required because of issues to do with affordability, growth and so on, would people's view be changed if a significant amount of that unearned, what Howard called the unearned increment, the land value uplift resulting from planning decisions, were ploughed back in local infrastructure, by which I mean not only improving roads and transport and education, but also green spaces, flooding protection. So it's, would your view be changed if you could be sure that the uplift in land values was put into, let's say, local infrastructure?
It doesn't work because you don't know what their view is to begin with.
Do you back the idea of ploughing a proportion, significant proportion, of the uplift in land values into local infrastructure?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, hands down. Nose.
It's not a fair question either.
Oh, well, that's true. You got to choose your questions too when you did your survey. Okay, this is what.
When it was loaded.
I think I'll just reprise my proposal in my third slide, which suggested that there should be a national commission looking at the land use in the long-term future, and that Greenbelt's review should be fitted within that. So my question to you is, do you think the government should immediately make a national commission on the future of land use in England?
Yes. Okay, hands down. Nose. Thank you very much. Well, just two more to go.
Thank you. I'm not sure I can have pleasure. Well, you know, I repeat the point I was making towards the end. I mean, I have a lot more faith in citizens than I do in politicians. The existing system is one that is designed to line the pockets of a few land owners. If we want to break down entrenched privilege in this country, we need to remove the mechanisms that enable a small amount of people to monopolise developable land. No one is calling for concreting over vast swathes of land. We are suggesting tiny patches of land could be developed to alleviate what's a very real housing and a very real cost of living crisis.
But if you've got faith in them, you should be able to ask them a question.
I do. Well, maybe I'll ask them if they agree with that point. Do you think that we should perpetuate a system that caused a housing and cost of living crisis at to the benefit of a few rich landowners?
Who wants to perpetuate the current system? Curious. Who wants to perpetuate it? Okay. Who doesn't want to perpetuate it? So it's all about getting to choose your question.
The question assumes that Greenbelt perpetuates that, which it doesn't, obviously. Greenbelt. One of the things that hasn't been demonstrated satisfactorily to me is whether it is Greenbelt that is preventing the development of all these houses, or whether it's just the lack of imagination of developers
to get on with delivering brownfield sites and developments outside the Greenbelt, of which, let's face it, the other 83% of the country is comprised, or thereabouts. Anyway, my question is this. Governments have, over the last 25 years, attempted to increase housing delivery by fiddling with planning on an increasingly regular basis. Since the 1990s, when they stopped building council housing, that's another question. Is it time, instead of fiddling with the planning system, to reform the property market instead?
Okay, is it time to reform the property market instead? Who's in favour? Anyway, then they get me right. And who's against reforming the property market?
Instead, I
prefer
as well.
Okay, yeah, exactly. Okay, so I'll do one last one for you. Who would leave the Oxford Greenbelt entirely unchanged? Any favour? Okay. And who would definitely want the Greenbelt to be altered? Thank you. Okay, thank you very, very much. You've been a brilliant audience. Thank you for our speakers.